host, Don Rush.
Could 2020 be the year of the woman headed to the White House? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. It was less than 4 years ago that Hillary Clinton stood on the stage at the Democratic National Convention to accept her party's presidential nomination. It was a historic moment for the country. They'd just seen the first African-American elected to the White House 8 years before. But the dream fell short in Electoral College as a newly minted Republican, Donald Trump, squeaked into the presidency. Despite the loss, women showed up in droves to protest his presence in the White House and spurred major gains for Democrats last year, with a surge of women candidates winning the races. Indeed, at least two male Democratic presidential candidates this year have said they expect a woman to be on the ticket one way or the other. All of this is a far cry from Geraldine Ferraro's ascension to the Democratic vice presidential nomination alongside Walter Mondale in 1984. Or the year of the woman, when a large number of ran for office in 1992 after the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearings in his nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. Take a look at the dramatic change in which around a half a dozen women have now openly declared their candidacy this year. In our studio is Janice Murphy. She's a political science professor at Salisbury University and teaches about women and politics. And welcome to the program.
Good morning, Don. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what is your own reaction or sense about the fact that we went from having one lone woman on a stage, both in Republican and Democratic race, actually, in 2016 to now six women, four of them senators?
Well, it's good to see, right? Because one of the values of having so many women running is that it's hard for people to say, well, I like her, but she should keep the job she has. You know, if you say that about all of them, it's a little questionable. So it's nice to see that diversity because it makes the issue of women, you know, we don't have a woman candidate. And so it makes it more of a viable option, more acceptable as an option.
So as I mentioned a moment ago, and I remember actually when Geraldine Ferraro was nominated, I was at the convention when it happened. How do you contrast that period of time in which obviously Walter Mondale was trying to restart his campaign with something new in terms of where we are now and how we moved through, I guess, 1992, which of course was the reaction to the Clarence Thomas hearings?
Right. Well, 1992 was interesting because I think that's when we got to double digits, mm-hmm. where you got, I think, 12 women in Congress. So so there were lovely graphs at the time that you could look at that showed the number of women in Congress being, you know, kind of flatlining. And then there's this big, looked like a big spike, but it's still not that many. And today we have, 127 mm-hmm. women in Congress. So it's a larger number. We went from 19% now to something like almost 23.6% of women right. in Congress. So it's a greater representation, but it's still, in both cases, we're looking at really incremental changes, right? We don't see women represented in Congress at the numbers they are in the population.
Why do you think that we have so many running this time out? And how has that image changed? I mean, and, you know, Hillary Clinton, one of the things she struggled with in her first time out was that she wanted to sort of distance herself from the idea of just running as a woman. In 2016, she seemed to embrace some of that. How do you see those images changing?
Well, I think you see so many women running right now because you see so many candidates running, right? So you've got just a large field of candidates, and just naturally a percentage of them are going to be women. It's something we'll have to look at because there's a great deal of literature that shows that women are covered differently by the media when they run, that there's some resistance in the population to women candidates, which kind of singles out Americans in contrast to other parts of the world, where there's much greater representation of women throughout the world, not just in developed countries. But so we're going to see how this shakes out. It's going to tell us a lot about whether we're getting more comfortable with seeing women ascend to these higher positions.
Although the current polls show Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, I think Obeto, they're like in ahead. And I think Kamala Harris, I think, comes in about 10%, something like that.
Yeah. Warren around 6.
Yeah. And so is that just simply, do you think, a matter of name recognition? Or do you think that there's some bias there in terms of how voters are viewing them?
I mean, a little both. I don't know how relevant anything is right now because these early, you know, the numbers don't mean much about how it's going to end up.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it tells us that much. I think that I'm encouraged by it, that we could see a female candidate win. A woman candidate emerge out of this. It's not necessarily going to be one of those three males who are early leaders.
One of the things that struck me, and I mentioned, is that at least two of them said that they expect a woman to be on the ticket one way or the other. It seems to be like the trend that may last.
Well, that's certainly an important trend for Democrats because they're just looking at their numbers because the Democratic Party is female, mm-hmm. right? The Republican Party is male. This is the way the numbers have run for a long time, and we're seeing that trend prevail. And they've got some interesting numbers in seeing that something like 70% of millennial women are either Democrats or lean Democratic. And that's really important number for them. And they're certainly seeing this trend showing strongly among, in Pew Research, what they're labeling Hispanic women and Black women, much more strongly leaning Democratic than men. So they're looking at that, and I think that you see that in Stacey Abrams being chosen to present the response to the State of the Union message. And Stacey Abrams is also somebody to consider. She hasn't declared, but she's as legitimate a candidate as Beto is, right?
Well, yeah.
Maybe
more so.
Right. She's a fascinating person and a really successful member of the Georgia legislature. So in my class, we've been following her for a while.
Mm.
She was not news to us because she's just a notable politician. So the Democrats are looking at women because that they've got to be responsive to their membership. Their membership's going to like that.
I mean, do you think in part, and I don't know whether this is necessarily something that's conscious or intentional, but that the Democratic Party is responding in part because of the kind of surge, and we'll talk about this in a moment, surge of disapproval of Trump, that Trump has produced this backlash. And they now, and Democrats, when they look at particularly women in terms of candidates and also in terms of voters, clearly were a factor in 2018. And there's a wave here that they intend to ride to the White House.
Right. And this doesn't come... This is not a recent development because if you look at it historically, I mean, you look at Congress, of these 127 women, 106 of them are Democrats. And that's not an accident. Part of it is the research in the last couple of years has shown that Democrats donate money to see diversity in candidates. It's now an ideological value of people who identify as Democrats, whereas you haven't seen that specific commitment to diversity among Republicans, so that it's not as if they won't support a female candidate, but it's not a goal to present more candidates of all of the options that are out there. Okay, so the Democrats have said yes, we want to see this, and we certainly saw that in the primaries where people with very similar positions, who were white males, were primaried out by women and by women of color. So, you saw Ayanna Pressley, you saw Ocasio-Cortez, step up because people wanted to see this change in among the Democrats. So you have a history of this in the Democratic Party. And then you couple that with this kind of response to the to the history of the kinds of statements that Trump has made. And so there is this moment in time where women are even more strongly responding to the Democratic Party numerically.
Right. As a matter of fact, I think it's Emily's List, which gives the Democrats, I think they raised something like $110 million last time out. Value in electing women, the GOP counterpart, $4.5 million.
Yeah.
Which shows, I mean, a clear difference. How much do you think, in terms of coming off of the 2016 election, how much value was there in having Hillary Clinton on the ticket and her legacy, at least in terms of as a candidate and as a force, I guess, within the Democratic Party on the one hand, as opposed to the reaction to Donald Trump on the other, in terms of how women are viewing politics now?
Well, there you saw the complexity of it, because Hillary, I think there's a rejection certainly among millennials of older politicians, and all of them are being scrutinized now in terms of their histories. So you saw the kind of not particularly being swept away by Hillary's history of support of women's issues, but certainly tying her to her husband's problematic history, right? In terms of policy positions, in terms of crime and, those kinds of policies also, got her in a lot of trouble. So millennials weren't captured by her history and weren't persuaded that she was speaking to them as a woman. Whereas older women were a little more captivated because of that shared history, because they started started further back.
Right. Exactly.
So they remember her presence. There was certainly a difference that related to where you were in age brackets. Okay. So that was an impact. So people, I think, stayed away because people thought she was going to win anyway. And I think for me, this upcoming election is all going to be about turnout, right? Because we know where people stand. It's who's going to get to the polls. And we know that a lot of people that didn't typically vote, for instance, older white males, came to the polls to vote for Trump in the last election. Which is interesting because women, since 1965 have outvoted men. They get to the polls more frequently. And women of color, black women, outvote everybody. There's a little data that tells us they're more optimistic about the impact of their vote. So perhaps that's why they're such killers at that. They just show up and vote. And, any demographic you're going to look at does not vote at the same high rates that black women do. But turnout was great. I think that probably the next presidential election is going to see high turnout on both sides, because people's emotions are stirred. And I think we'll continue to be stirred around these issues.
I mean, do you think that millennial women, particularly in 2016, do you think that in some ways they took for granted the progress that had already been made, as opposed to, say, the older women who obviously they can see the history and say, well, wait a minute, and this is really important. We gotta keep this. I mean, I don't know.
I think that the reason millennial women leaning so strongly Democratic, to me, that's because of things like response to child separation policies at the border. It's response to maybe things like fear of losing reproductive rights. And healthcare is a huge issue among millennials. So they're going to be interested more in people talking about Medicare for All. They're going to be interested in preserving Obamacare at a minimum. And also, of course, very interested in physical safety issues. So all of the Me Too movement is very relevant to millennial women. For instance, one division I saw that was generational was the response to Al Franken resigning his position in the Senate. And women my age, women, older women, who were Democrats, split hairs on that and said, oh gosh, you know, I've been attacked and I've been harassed, and I can tell you one is much worse than the other, and what he did wasn't all that bad, and da da da. And younger women said, sorry, he's got to go. That's not acceptable. That's just not cool. And I found that fascinating, right? The millennial women were saying, we have a standard. And if the Democratic Party doesn't have the standard, I think had the Democratic Party embraced and kept their support, encouraged Franken to stay, if, for instance, Jill Brand had done that, millennial woman would say, I don't see the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. It's not enough of a difference for me. So you do see a stronger position. They know their rights.
Right.
They're very clear-sighted on this. They're not going to say, oh, well, boys will be boys. They're not having it. So there is that kind of generational difference. So rather than say they were taking things for granted, I'd put a more positive spin on where millennials are coming from. They just have a positive sense of who they are.
I mean, do you think that older politicians are getting caught in this transition that's taking place? I mean, that the bar is continuously moving, although we still have Donald Trump, which is a separate issue here, but that there seems to be a shifting. Because, matter of fact, I recently saw the film about Gary Hart. And
yeah.
Right, it's 3 weeks. Yeah. And when I looked at it, it was like so quaint, right? Because he had an affair.
Well, go back even further to the notion of those journalistic accounts that was it Whitaker's book, The Boys on the Bus.
Yeah.
In the old days, Estes Kefauver and, the old days in the 50s, where it was widely known that all of these male politicians had girlfriends on the side, and as they went on the campaign tour, they'd whatever. But the polite thing was to not speak about it. Don't embarrass the little woman at home, don't make a fuss. But it was widely happening and never spoken of. And we know that we've had many, many elected officials in the 50s and the 60s who were having affairs, and it was just accepted. So the transition in my lifetime, is pretty dramatic. And there is a difference between, of course, and this is important to point out, there's a difference between having affairs and having consensual sexual activity and forced sexual activity. So these are two different issues to talk about. And that's where I think we sometimes get confused, because when people talk about sexual conduct and say, oh, well, there's some question about sexual conduct, it's what let's not use that term. Let's be clear. Is this consensual or not? So, I think that's the problem today is seeing this kind of behavior and calling it out. And the Me Too movement, I think, has been sparked by many, many things. But certainly women have been galvanized to become politically active because of the fact that we have a president who has bragged about not asking
Salt.
Before he acted.
Right.
Right.
To say the least, yeah.
Yeah, and this is important, too, because historically you have not been able to persuade women to run for office. So one of the big challenges to those terrible numbers, to us not having even a threshold of 30% where you might be able to talk about women's impact in politics, so we're not even at 30% yet after all this time, is because it's hard to persuade women to run for office. And the reason was this kind of modesty, this saying, oh, I don't know if I could get elected. I don't know how good I'd be. That this is more characteristic of qualified women than it is of qualified men. But every so often, women, in 92 and now again, right, in this last election in the fall, women looked around and said, I'm as good as these incumbents. What am I worried about? So you saw women electing themselves, or you saw women being recruited by more progressive organizations, not necessarily through the traditional hierarchy, and responding to that and saying, yes. And that's a change that you're seeing. And that is a response to seeing behavior that they didn't like among politicians and saying, yeah, I'm better than that and I'm qualified to run. And so you saw, I think that's the thing that we're trying to monitor right now. Is this a change that we're going to see going forward, or was this a specific response to a moment in time?
I mean, how much do you think this is also simply a reaction to, not just simply that the president has bragged about sexual assault, because we saw that in Access Hollywood tape, but just the crudeness of it all? I mean, do you think that, I mean, obviously related to that, but just in general?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I cannot imagine when I think about, well, what if Jeb Bush had been elected president? Would the reaction have been the same? And I suspect not. I mean, I think there's a character dimension to this reaction, not just simply to a policy. I don't know.
I think that's true, but again, I imagine you would still see a generational split on any politician if egregious behavior of sexual harassment, sexual assault, were to happen, that younger women would call it out no matter who it is. And yeah, it's the crudity of it, it's probably more offensive to older women.
So in terms of issues, I mean, you mentioned a few of them, but this idea that there is a possibility, particularly obviously with the courts now being filled with appointments by this president, you know, issues like the Affordable Care Act, which I read, I guess there's a piece this morning and there's a book coming out about Chief Justice John Roberts, who moved back and forth and then ultimately decided to save the Affordable Care Act. Obviously, had Brett Kavanaugh on the way. His accuser was treated, separation fear, even on the abortion issue. We just saw just recently where there's, I think one of the states has now said they're passing a law that says heartbeat, which would be before you may even know that you're pregnant. I mean, so you see all these things happening. How much of a pushback? I mean, are particularly millennial women, are they aware that there's something coming at them?
Probably not.
No.
Probably not. This has been coming at them for a while, these changes at the local level, right? These state houses have been happening, and access to abortion is just severely limited. People aren't being trained in med school, and you know, people have to travel out of state to find providers. So there's lots and lots of restrictions that exist currently on the availability, even though we have Wade still to this day. So I'm not sure that there's an appreciation of that issue entirely. But and we do see, it's kind of interesting, and a lot of it has to do with our electoral system, that the population overall is more progressive than the legislators we elect who are making these restrictions. It's not necessarily reflective of the majority of the population. It tends to be, and that's, I think, why you see so many women, so the splits among women, where women are not all voting Democratic by any means. And one of the reasons is women split on reproductive rights, and women work very hard on both sides of that issue.
So, well, speaking of Republican women, I mean, what do you make of them in terms of this shift that's going on? Senator Marsha Blackburn, I think, was elected first woman actually in Tennessee, I guess. Where do they fit in all of this? I mean, Republicans, as a matter of fact, I think lost some women seats in the last election.
Yeah, so they'll lose more, apparently. They're going to go down. Yeah, the data says Republican women get elected in areas that are more Democratic.
More Democratic, with a capital D, yeah.
More Democratic areas tend to elect those women. Again, I think Republican women probably are voting, you know, women split on all kinds of issues, right? We don't just have one identity. Right. So there's class, there's religion, there's region, there's, you know, what kind of family ideology did you grow up with? You know, all those things impact. And I think that a lot of the voters that I've talked to who are, you know, gay men or women who voted for Trump were looking at abortion as their issue. So that is a reason I think some women cleave to the Republican Party, because they're single issue voters. And so they'll ignore other concerns because that's a primary issue for them. And that's one of the things I've been hearing a lot. And I don't know what data supports that, but it's just that's just some sense I make of it. But certainly, I mean, women since 2004, white women, have voted for a Republican for president. White women have not, for instance, either time voted for Obama. Now, more white women voted for Obama than white men did, certainly. But Obama wasn't elected by white women. So when we talk about women in politics, there are these important distinctions to be made.
Right.
When we're talking about women voting more Democratic, it's because of the impact of women of color. On those issues.
On the issue of abortion, the public opinion seems to have been fairly stable over a number of decades in terms that there's not a lot of movement one way or the other. And obviously, depending upon when you know, how you ask the question and what restrictions and so on, you get differences.
Yes.
Are you surprised that that has not changed over the years?
Yeah, I think that you see little fluctuations as people feel it's being too restricted. People get more pro-choice when they feel that it's too easily available, and you know they don't want people using it as a form of birth control. Then they get a little concerned, and I think that people my generation think about the fact that you can't make it go away, so let's have it safe and legal and work on making it less necessary. Let's talk about birth control. Let's talk about other options. But let's not go back to back alley abortions, which again, my generation remembers. So there's that kind of complexity around the issue that you can see out there. But yeah, I think we are firmly in our camps. I'm not really surprised by that. I think it's going to stay that way.
So, any predictions, any thoughts about who, the closing minute here or two we got, in terms of particularly the women, in terms of how they might do, we got everybody from Kamala Harris to Elizabeth Warren, and we may be joined by a few others before it's all over.
Yeah.
Or any sense about how they, how what kind of reflection of the views that they have. I mean, there does seem to be a certain, Warren is probably further maybe to left, for lack of a better term, than maybe some of the other women.
Yeah.
I mean, although it's been a very small scale, of course.
Yeah, no, certainly more than Tulsi Gabbard.
Yeah.
I only wish that there was more interest in their issue positions and less interest in seeing which of these Democratic candidates could win, because that's a strategy that doesn't always work.
Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Didn't work for Kerry. Right. I think he's the salient example here.
Yeah.
But I don't think any of them is polling strongly right now.
Right.
But
it's still early.
And I suppose Harris is the most charismatic. Hmm. And Democrats want to fall in love. And that's the challenge that these women face. Because women, the electorate finds it harder to love women than it does to love men.
Well, I'm going to leave it on that note. I'm sure we'll explore that later. We've been talking with Janice Murphy. She's a political science professor at Salisbury University. Also teaches women and politics. Appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thanks so much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. National Folk Festival unveils four more musical acts for this fall. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The four acts announced this week and feature the influence of the Balkans and Hawaii to the sounds of rap and Appalachian banjo tradition. We have in our studio this morning Caroline O'Hare. She's the local manager for the National Folk Festival here in Salisbury. And on the phone with us is Julia Olin. She's artistic director for Special Projects and Initiatives with the National Council for the Traditional Arts. And welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks.
So first of all, I want to turn to you, Caroline. Tell me then a little bit about the fact that we're having, obviously, this announcement, and we're going to have some more announcements as time goes by.
I feel like this came along quickly, and we're just so excited. It's such a diverse and amazing group of artists, and we've got one of the best go-go bands, a legendary go-go band coming for free to Salisbury, which is amazing. And then this incredible storyteller and musician from the Appalachian traditions, all these just amazing things that are coming here again for free. And again, our planning and our prep work is full steam ahead. We've got two deadlines fast approaching. April 1st, applications for the festival marketplace, which is exclusively featuring artisans and craftspeople from Maryland and the Delmarva Peninsula. Applications are due April 1st. And then also on that same day, food vendor applications are also due. So we are just moving right ahead. And if you are an artist or a craftsperson or a food vendor and you would like to apply, get your application in now, nationalfolkfestival.com.
So let's take a look at what's been announced. Julia, we have a group actually who features Balkan music out of the Balkans. Tell me then a little bit about this group and how you pronounce their name.
The name of the group is Tamburashki Sastav Ponoch. And Tamburashki actually means tamburitsa, Sastav ensemble, and Ponoch midnight. So this is the Midnight Tamburitsa Ensemble in English. And this is a brilliant group of young players. Now, I would say, you know, the tamburitsa tradition is essentially Balkan string band music. It has at least a 500-year-old year history. And it's music that came to this country with the wave of Eastern European immigration coming into the industrial Midwest. And it's been actually, tamburitsa music has been flourishing in this country for over a century. So these young guys are bringing this music out of, you know, neighborhood taverns and community halls onto the concert stage in this country and beyond. In fact, they are considered rock stars in Croatia. The five primary instruments of the tamburitsa ensemble are all in the lute family, and they range from the prim, which is a soprano instrument, to the berda, which is a bass. These guys all met during their college years at Duquesne University, where they were part of the famous Duquesne University Tamburitsans. And they all grew up with the music as well.
So in terms of the kind of thing that they draw upon, I understand they it draws everything from Gypsy to Macedonian to Italian influences, that the whole sort of southern Mediterranean region out there, and I guess in the eastern side of it.
Well, that's true, but primarily they're focused on the music of Croatia, Bosnia, Herzegovina, and Serbia, and as you said, with these other influences as well. And I am telling you, they are virtuosos. This is very lively, exciting, fast-paced music, beautiful harmony singing as well.
I mean, one of the things, matter of fact, and we'll hear about it in a moment, is it almost reminded me something out of Zorba the Greek. The kind of instruments you're looking at.
Yeah, it does have some of that flavor. That's certainly true.
Let's take a listen.
Kod kuće, samo tvoj sam, nije šala, ti se ljubiš najslađe, da mi daju pola radnog crijema, od tebe mi nije.
But what language, by the way, is that? Do you know?
I believe they're singing in Croatian on this particular cut.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's a certain, like, sort of Slavic quality to it, but there's a certain romance kind of quality, I think, to the sounds, I think, is at least what I'm hearing anyway. So let's move to something that's completely different, Rare Essence. It was called the Premier Go-Go Band, and it's a DMV band. Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, for those who don't follow Go-Go, what the DMV means, that's D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. And this is really the region, particularly D.C., where Go-Go developed. And Go-Go is an offshoot of funk. And it was pioneered by the great D.C. guitarist Chuck Brown. And it's a blend of Latin beats, call and response, rhythm and blues, gospel, jazz, and it's all layered over a signature percussion pattern. And Go-Go is one of those musics that flirted with fame in the 80s, 1980s and 1990s, never quite made it, became a mainstay on the national scene. However, locally, oh my gosh, it is has remained tremendously popular, and it's more of an experience. It's the idea of the interaction between the crowd and the band, and Go-Go, it's just an all-night session, it's an all-night party. And Rare Essence is really considered to be, for the longest time, one of the foundational groups, and remains today one of the best and most popular Go-Go bands. These guys all met when they were in high school together at St. Thomas More Catholic Academy in D.C. And while there are still a number of original members, but the band has incorporated some younger folks that actually grew up listening to their parents' cassettes of Go-Go music.
Tell me then a little bit about, I guess when early on they were, I think, they had named themselves the Young Dynamos. I mean, this has really changed over a long period of time because they were established in the mid-70s?
That's right. They started in the late 70s. And RE means, they're RE to the fans, but means Rare Essence.
Mm-hmm. And do they play then a lot then in the region then? Is that it?
Yeah, they're still playing at least twice a week in clubs, although they're a little bit worried that gentrification is encroaching upon and affecting some of the traditional clubs that they've played in. You can still go hear them anytime.
Hey, I understand that they play something like more than 5,000 times.
Oh, yeah. I mean, these guys are Go-Go warriors, and I can't, for those who haven't experienced Go-Go, for those who have, know this is going to be an amazing experience, and for those who haven't, I would urge them to check this band out because it's so much fun.
Well, let's take a little taste of it.
Synchronize your time and let's rock.
Caroline, you were listening to it real quick here. What's
yeah? I've actually been to a few Go-Go shows in D.C. That is a show where you dance, you move, you can't stop. And actually, it's infiltrated. I'm sure Julia can speak more to this, but our mainstream artists, even Beyonce's Single Ladies, is heavily influenced by Go-Go. It's It's a band and a music that you will not be able not to dance to.
And we should mention also that they're going to be joined by an honorary member, the DC bred DJ and MC named DJ Cool, who grew up on Go-Go and whose earlier releases certainly reflect that influence. And you can hear in this music, I'm sure everybody's heard Bucket Drummers on the Streets, this is the beat.
In many ways, as a matter of fact, it reminds me of what I remember. I'm trying to think whether it's the late 70s or early 80s of originally hip hop, which was emphasis on dancing. The guy, and it was very unusual at the time. I've never heard anything like it before. And this seems like it's really sort of an outgrowth of that hip hop era.
Well, this is certainly an American urban tradition, and it's got all sorts of close connections to hip-hop, as well as, you know, other funk styles.
Well, to turn to the Hawaiian influence here, Kahulu Nui. Tell me a little bit about this. 1930s music heard in the Hawaiian ballrooms at one point.
Oh, we are so excited that we could get this band. Kahulu Nui plays what you would call Hawaiian big band swing. Now, in the, you know, there's always been this musical interchange between Hawaii and the mainland with instruments like the Hawaiian steel guitar, you know, infiltrating the mainland music and becoming a mainstay in musics like blues and country. But the influences work the other way as well. You know, in the 30s, Hawaiian hotel ballrooms were full of island swing bands. And Lena Kaipo, who is the leader of Kahulu Nui, his grandfather, Robert, helped lead the Royal Hawaiian Orchestra in the 1930s. And his youth playing had a strong impression on his young grandson. And Lena's father toured the world as a musical ambassador for Hawaiian and Aloha Airlines. So Lena, for most of his career, had been playing with small combos. But one day he was in the studio, and he showed his producer a YouTube clip of Ray Kinney, who is Hawaiian singer and swing band leader who played hundreds of army bases starting in the 1920s. And he said, this is what I really want to do. I want to bring back this music that my grandfather, you know, played and was a part of. And so they've taken Hawaiian instruments and melodies and the Hawaiian language and blended those together with a really swinging big band jazz sound.
As a matter of fact, now they include, I mean, everything from sax and trumpet. I mean, as I was looking at the picture, by the way, of the group, I mean, there's a lot of brass or a lot of instruments you recognize.
Absolutely, but fronted by the ukulele, and often the lyrics to the songs are in Hawaiian and have got that, you know, that kind of characteristic Hawaiian beat in the way that it's delivered. It is. The first time I heard it, I was like, "Oh my God, this is fantastic!"
and what they also appeared on, I think, it was a national radio program called Hawaii Calls.
Yeah, that was one way that the Hawaiian big band sound became popular during World War II throughout the entire United States.
And how popular is it now? I mean, is it continues to be on the islands, or is it spread out? What sense do you get?
Well, this group has formed only in the past, since 2013, or something like that. And so they're at the forefront of bringing this sound back. But it coincides with a renaissance of the Hawaiian language on the islands. So they're in the vanguard, I would say, of bringing back a great Hawaiian sound that's sort of been neglected.
Let's take a little listen. almost imagine the GIs and the rest of those folks are in those ballrooms.
You can. And Lena, the group leader, the first time I saw him, I just kept smiling and laughing because he reminds me of got a big personality, and he reminds me of a Hawaiian Cab Calloway.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and if people go to nationalfolkfestival.com, you know, we've got music and video clips there for people to look at, to review, as well as the group bio. And there is a great video clip of this group, I have to say.
I want to turn finally to Sheila K. Adams. Comes out of North Carolina and plays kind of a Southern Appalachian ballads.
Well, here we're talking about traditions that even predate the founding of the United States. They date back to the earliest days of settlement in this country. Sheila K. Adams is, I would say, the finest exponent of Appalachian songs, stories, and ballads. She is the seventh generation of her family to carry on these traditions. And she's from a little bitty community deep in the Blue Ridge Mountains called Sodom Laurel. It's in Madison County, North Carolina. And so named, apparently, because an itinerant Baptist preacher was traveling through and noted a brothel nearby. So he's responsible for this. So this is a tradition that comes down from the Scots-Irish and English settlers from the mid-17th century. And Sheila Kay learned from her great-aunt, Dellie Chandler, and other noted families that carried on the tradition of unaccompanied ballad singing, like Dillard Chandler and the Wallen family. So this is, she's not only a great singer of unaccompanied ballads, she's an amazing storyteller with a very dry and wry sense of humor, and a Clawheimer banjo player as well.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that. I saw a little of it when I was at least saw the pictures and so on. What's it like in terms of the kind of play that you get on the banjo?
The clawhammer style?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a very woody, plunky sound, and it's not, you know, like bluegrass banjo.
Mm-hmm.
You have picks on your hand, and it's an up-picking style, very bright and crisp. The clawhammer style is really a really old style. You can find it in Africa, and you're hitting down with your fingers on the strings, and then just plucking the fifth string with your thumb. So it's like, it's very woody and natural sounding, and I don't know, you just hear echoes of the century in that style to me.
And this, as you said, this dates back at least mid-17th century. And it has some, what, Scottish and Irish, English roots? What's the background on that?
Yes, that's right. And a lot of the ballads were centuries old before they got to this country. And the community that Sheila Kay is from there in Madison County has been a place where folklorists have been going for a long time, to collect these ballads and notate them. Francis James Child in the second half of the 19th century, Cecil Sharp in the early 20th century. So it's really a small place, but quite famous for the keeping of these traditions.
Can you give a sense about the kinds of stories that she tells?
Well, she really tells stories about, like, Dellie Chandler, who she calls Granny. And so these are not like, she doesn't tell like Jack tales. She tells stories from her own life and her experiences growing up in the mountains. And they're frankly hilarious. She has two books, Come Go Home With Me, which is semi-autobiographical collection of short stories. She has a novel, My Own True Love. She appeared in Last of the Mohicans and Songcatcher, where she also served as technical advisor and singing coach.
And I guess she's been teaching, what, for about 17 years, something like that?
She's what?
She's been teaching, what, a long time?
Teaching?
Yeah. Music and storytelling. And
oh,
kind of
yeah.
Thing. Yeah.
She started performing publicly while she was in her teens. You know, first, this tradition is one where locally singers would get together and swap songs. So she began in her teens, and then, her circle has expanded over these many years. She's been at the International Storytelling Festival, and she was awarded both a North Carolina Heritage Award and a National Heritage Fellowship, which is the nation's highest honor for folk and traditional arts.
Caroline?
Oh, I just absolutely adore her. I was so excited to hear that she was coming. The stories that she tells, as Julia said, are hilarious, and they're true, and they're raw. But she paints these pictures. It just draws you in, and you are just mesmerized by her voice, by her style, just the topics. It's incredible. If I could, I would stay wherever she was all day and just hang on her every word. I cannot wait for everyone to experience just the magic of her.
Well, let's take a little listen.
Say, little darling, don't say a word. Daddy's gonna buy you a mockingbird. Say, darling, say. And if that mockingbird won't sing, Daddy's gonna buy you a diamond ring. Say, darling, say. If that diamond turns to brass, Daddy's gonna buy you a looking glass. Say, darling, say.
It reminds me, Julius, I grew up in the 1960s, in which, of course, folk music became very big, and many people were actually reaching back into the archives to find old songs, and it sounds like she's really reached back and found a sound that almost harkens back to that period.
Well, the difference is she grew up with these sounds. These sounds were all around her. These songs were and ballads were sung by her family and neighbors. So in that way, you can distinguish who she is and what she does from those of the 1960s who were inspired by the music that's been kept in her community all these centuries.
So, Caroline, what do we expect then coming up in terms of we got some announcements, more announcements, that kind of thing?
We do.
What kind of more music are we looking at here?
Well, just exciting surprises around every corner.
Right.
But as I stated before, April 1st, we have our deadline for our marketplace and for our food vendors. And then in April, we'll probably have another announcement of some more artists and a few other things coming up. So if you want to find out about all the latest and greatest news, subscribe to our email list on nationalfolkfestival.com. Like us on Facebook. We're constantly posting new information. And we're also partnering with Delmarva Public Radio, right, with Salisbury Independent. Pac 14 is always amazing. We love them. And so tune on to your local favorites here, and you'll be up to date with all the new news from the festival.
By the way, how is this, your experience, differing, and it's still early on, from like what you guys were involved with as it was last year? Because, I mean, last year obviously was the first time you were sort of inventing the wheel, I mean, to some extent. But now you have at least one of these things under your belt.
We were. We had this incredible support and guidance from the NCTA, from Julia and from her team. And they helped us. Like you said, we built it from scratch for Salisbury, because every town is different. You can't just bring a festival and use the same template. This year, we have all our systems in place. We understand what certain terms mean and things mean. And so we're sort of grooving and moving ahead. We still have, challenges. Of course, we have challenges. That would be boring if you didn't. But we're working hard to make this festival even better than last year. We're streamlining things. We're looking at ways to improve, looking at ways to grow. We know that the crowd is going to grow. So we're looking at that. And just, I, now that we know what this crazy thing is, we're so excited, and I'm pumped to be back again this year.
Hey, and you're going to be needing lots of volunteers. And how was it last? Did you get a turnout?
We got quite a few volunteers. Yeah. We got over 1,200 volunteers, which was incredible. And we also, with our surveys after the festival, we have, I believe, 98% said that they plan to return as volunteers. We are going to kick off that recruitment in April. So stay tuned for news for that. And you'll be able to pick, again, your job, the time, the day that you want to volunteer. And we would love to have you.
Well, we were speaking with Julia Olin. She is the Artistic Director for Special Projects and Initiatives, National Council for Traditional Arts, and Caroline O'Hare. She's the local manager for the National Folk Festival here in Salisbury. And appreciate both of you stopping by and chatting with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit pac14.org.